And I say that to say, you know, like, we've been practicing these things for centuries. Our ancestors were practicing these same things in maybe a slightly different way. If that, it's just evolved over time. But if society isn't able to put a price tag on it for some reason, it's just not deemed worthy enough to pay attention to. And I find that really interesting and also kind of sad.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Alfredo González Valenzuela, and you are now at the Climate Frontline.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you may be. My name is Alfredo, and welcome to the Climate Frontline podcast, the show where I engage with leaders in social movements, industries, artists, to just have conversations that are going to change the narrative around how we talk about climate change by centering those communities who are at the front line of climate change. And our community does this one conversation at a time. Hey, welcome to day 3 of Community Week here at the Climate Frontline podcast. I am excited to have this third conversation this week with Toby. Toby is a good friend of mine, and I'm just excited to share this conversation with you today. So let's get started. So today, I am delighted to welcome in Toby into the show. Toby, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi. Hey, y'all. How's it going?
Toby, for those folks that may not know you, I would love for you to just share a little bit about who you are and what is it that you love doing in this journey called life.
Okay. I do a lot, so I'm going to try to keep it as short and sweet as possible. But I met you, Alfredo, through Presidio Graduate School. So I'm a student there. I'll be finished in the spring, thank goodness. I'm so ready to graduate. I work currently as an operations manager for a small nonprofit consulting company out of Los Angeles. I also work within a multitude of organizations. So I'm a social media manager, volunteering for the National Urban League Young Professionals, which is one of the oldest civil rights organizations. I also work with, I guess, my own little projects, like Emotionally Unavailable, which is a podcast that you can find on all streaming platforms. I do a few things, but I'll keep it short and simple for that. And I'm just trying to, you know, make space for voices like myself to share whatever we have to give to the world, which can be across a bunch of different topics and platforms. And I'm super excited to talk to you today about all the things we're going to talk about.
Yeah, there's plenty to talk about, right? I'm curious, what is your favorite food or fruit? Do you pair it up with mimosas?
Yes. I actually have one. Well, this is like leftover. I've been adding like sparkling water to it, but it was a margarita with some pineapple in it. And now it's like a watered down drink. But that's, yeah. So I think pineapple.
Pineapple?
Nice. Yeah.
I can get into pineapples. Cool. Well, you know, thanks for joining me in the show. I think you have a pretty good idea already of what this show is about because we know each other, and you know that I already, before even putting together this podcast, I was already focused a lot on the language that people used because it's just so pivotal to how we communicate, you know?
Completely.
And so I wanted to ask you about just like, how is it that you navigate language, first of all, and how does it show up in your everyday life?
Yeah, language in general. So I'm a native English speaker, and I learned French starting in high school and learned a little bit more in college. I was fluent for a little bit, but I don't get to use it as much now, so I don't know if I can call myself fluent. I understand Spanish a little bit, but I don't speak it. And I understand a little bit of Italian. And then I have these like language apps that I use, and I've been learning a little bit here and there through that. So any given day, maybe one day I'll be fluent in like more than two languages, give or take, hopefully. I really need to learn Spanish. Every time I talk to you, I feel like I'm like, shit, I am really freaking terrible at Spanish. Like, I'm not good at talking. But I think, so for me, like, being, growing up in a household that was English native speakers, I think that that's kind of, it's kind of limiting a little bit in terms of the context of the world and like globalization as we know it right now, because when you go to any other countries, which I've been, you know, able to go to quite a few different times, you can tell that like other countries take the time to learn different languages. So even if their language is native English, you know, they'll learn another language in high school or something like that, or even like through primary school. And I think we do that a little bit in the United States, but not as much. And it's definitely not like something that you, that is mandatory or necessary. Whereas in other countries, you have to learn a second language or a third language in order to, you know, exist in the society that you're living in. So I wish that was something that was pushed a little bit more, because it just connects people. And that's how I view languages. And I feel like connections and building relationships and communicating in general is just really integral to being able to progress forward with all of the different, things that you're trying to do. And to me, I really like understanding what other people are trying to say, how they're trying to use their words, and what that really looks like. And I feel like it's really important to be able to do that in a multitude of ways and not just one way, or not just the way that you grew up learning how to communicate with people. So
yeah. And I know in your podcast, the language there is a lot more friendly and more loose, I would describe it as. Whereas like if you're in a corporate space, the language there, I think, is a little... It's a lot different, right? It's a lot different, mm-hmm. and it's not as loose, I would say.
For sure.
So there's those two sides. But tell me a little bit about what you see in terms of difference between this coast and the West Coast and the other coast and the East Coast. What are some things you see there?
Yeah, I mean, so I grew up in the South, and so I don't have an accent necessarily, like a Southern accent, I guess, that most people think of when they think of the Southern United States. But for me, even the South and like the Northeast is like completely different in terms of language use and like the dialects that come out of the different regions. And so when you say like East Coast, it's really funny, because when I'm home, which I consider the South home, I consider North Carolina home, like when I'm home, you know, you hear people who are talking about, oh, like New Yorkers, and that's like one region. And you hear people who are talking about like Georgia or the South, you know, like the Dirty South, that's what they call it, or that's what some people call it. And that's like people who, like within my culture, which is Black American culture, they'll use like Ebonics, or they'll use ABE, which is like African American Vernacular English. So it depends on what you mean by which region. I think it's definitely different. Like, there's segments. It's a lot more segmented on the East Coast Whereas on the West Coast, it's like you have California and you have the Pacific Northwest, and that's it. Yeah. And that's like interesting that California is such a huge state. And so even within, like, you have the Bay and you have that kind of, you know, how people interact and how they utilize their language up there. And then you have Southern California, which is where I'm at now. And people, I think Southern California is so weird because it's such a transient city in terms of people coming in and out. You know, people want to come here, experience Hollywood. Maybe it's not all it's cracked up to be for them. They'll go back or they'll go somewhere else in California. Or even going to the Pacific Northwest, which is where I lived for like 3 years. And the way that people communicate there is super interesting and completely different from where I grew up or went to college. So that was definitely, it was like having to enter into a different part of society for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I like what you're saying, because I think it's true in many places, although, you know, you can characterize the West Coast as one, it's pretty diverse within two, right? And just like that, I'm sure the East Coast is that way. I haven't spent much time in that side of the country, but yeah, I like what you're saying. Tell me, I'm curious, in the places that, you know, you've been and you relate to in the East Coast, this term sustainability that you and I both understand, maybe as it relates to our time during Presidio graduate school. But I'm curious to know, because it's different, because the language is different, because the people, the demographics are different, the land, the weather is different, even the ocean is different, right? How is it that, maybe they're not even using this term specifically, but I'm curious to know, how is it that they're talking about these issues? Or are they not talking about it even with the word sustainability? Maybe they're talking about it with something else.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I think it's interesting that on the West Coast, and especially like in the Bay Area, or actually I feel like it's in general, just on the West Coast, sustainability is like a huge thing. And they use that word, sustainability. That's like its own sector. You can find jobs within it. If you like search on LinkedIn, you can say sustainability manager, you'll probably find a ton of jobs, you know, on the West Coast or based out of the West Coast, or even like the Midwest a little bit. Whereas the East Coast, like when I was, it was probably more recent than anything, because I'm looking for a job right now, or like whatever, you know, looking for a full-time job. And just like
cruising around LinkedIn. Toby's amazing. Make sure to hit her up.
Yeah, no, but yeah, looking like trying to like think about where I want to live next, because I don't plan on staying in Southern California. It's not going to happen. But I want to go back home eventually, or like somewhere close to home. And you don't really find a lot of sustainability jobs, quote unquote.
Yeah.
It on the East Coast, that's not a thing. Like, I don't know. And I don't even know if I would say that the movement isn't down there. There's definitely a lot of progression being made in terms of thinking about climate change and trying to understand, you know, how we can be more sustainable in a lot of different ways. But it looks completely different. And I think I haven't lived on the East Coast or like in the South for so long that I don't even know what it really looks like. So I wouldn't even know like what keywords to use and things of that nature. Like it's not characterized the same. And that's really, really different. And also the practices are different. You don't have like a grocery bag tax in the South. Or even on the East Coast. I think maybe in New York they have it now, but yeah, it's not, that's not a huge thing. But I remember when I first moved to Seattle a few years ago, that was a huge thing. I was like, you're charging me 10 cents for a bag, grocery bag? And then like, oh, just get reusable grocery bags. And that's just like a normal thing. Or even like recycling bins. That's not really a thing, excuse me, a thing in you know, like apartment buildings or anything like that. And even there's even changes. If you go from state to state, like in Seattle, it was a lot easier for me to compost because they had actual compost bins where I live. Whereas like down here in Los Angeles, it's not really a thing that like people don't really compost unless you like live in a house or have a garden nearby or things like that. So even like the practices and the ways that people carry like day to day sustainability and like that whole sector isn't really prevalent depending on where you go, or it's characterized as something else. Because when I was growing up, like we were sustainable by definition, I guess, like we saved our grocery bags when we, you know, like had a pile of them under the sink and stuff, which I know a lot of families did. You know, we like reused cups and, you know, didn't really use straws or something like that. Like there are different practices, but I think when you smack a label on it or smack like, oh, that's being sustainable, and take it into this like characteristic or even this persona, right? You live green and stuff, and like that's like over here, like on the West Coast, to me, like that's being green and like being sustainable is something that you can like commodify. There's people on Instagram now, and I mean that's also just the way that culture is moving, but like there's people on Instagram now who are like sharing the ways that you can go green and like sharing the ways that you can be more sustainable and think about climate change more. That wasn't really happening when I was growing up, and that wasn't the language that was used. It was just like, yeah, we don't throw plastic bags away. You can use that as like a trash can, or you can use that as
just
like,
common sense,
you know, a shower cap and stuff like that. Yeah, so
yeah,
we don't care about it the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even my parents will come up with some random things once in a while that is like they're reusing it. And, you know, I'm not there to point it out to them that like, hey, you're being sustainable, because like if I do, then like I just don't, because that's not
well,
what
then
it is
becomes
to me.
A thing. And like, again, that whole like idea of commodifying the way that you live your lifestyle, and that makes it, I don't know, there's like good and bad things about it. I think it's great that there are companies that are based on utilizing natural products and, you know, based on people being able to, you know, like bring in, or what is it called, you have like a keg or a growler, right? And you can like bring it back into the restaurant to fill it up with beer or like drinks or something like that. I think that's great. And I also think that there are inherent practices that a lot of our communities have always used and always continued to practice. And we don't have to like pay for it, or, you know, like put an extra cost on it or commodify it in a way that makes it kind of out of touch or out of reach for, you know, our families to continue practicing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, long before the environmental movement, our communities were doing that. And yeah. I totally get that. I'm curious to know, you know, like you were saying, you know, in the West Coast and maybe in other parts of the country too, this sustainability term and industry is pretty apparent, right? And I actually really struggle with it, and I actually think it should be called something else. And I'm curious to know what you would call it. I'll just share what I think it should be called. I think it should be called like consumption, like professionals, you know? That I think to me gets more at the fact that like you're quantifying carbon emissions, you're quantifying these things. But to me, sustainability professional, like, I just don't think there's such thing as a professional, a sustainability professional. Cause like, to me, like someone who is really grasping at full what sustainability is doesn't need that title and doesn't need academia and doesn't need XYZ things. You know, they're just mothers, a lot of women out there who are growing the food, who are educating the youth, who are, you know, the backbone of our economies. And that to me is who, quote unquote, sustainability professionals would be. And I don't want them to be professional sustainability. I just want them to be themselves, you know? So I'm curious to know, what are your thoughts on that? And you know, keeping in mind that a lot of our colleagues, right, are in that space, and I have great respect for them. And I'm not trying to say that they shouldn't keep pushing because they do amazing stuff. I'm just making space to discuss the fact that, like, the diction around sustainability needs to be decolonized and brought into a new scale, right? Or a new paradigm.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's just what we were just saying, right? Like, when you think about what classifies as sustainability or classifies as being, being reusable or regenerative, right? Like, we've been practicing that for centuries. And especially, like, communities where people of color have existed for a while, like in indigenous communities, those things have been practiced for God knows how long and in different ways, right? But then when you think about the society that we operate in as it stands right now and the ways that There's just, I'm trying to get my words straight. Like, essentially, when you think about how our society is kind of like your labor is how you determine your worth, right? And your, the way that you, whatever job you have, that's how you contribute to society. And that's pretty much the only way how you generate things and what is the outcome of what work you're putting in. That's how we determine what's worthy of, you know, commodifying and also worthy of us paying attention to. And so something like saving trash bags under a sink, that's not something that sustainability professionals necessarily quantify. And that's not going to generate income for a company or an individual necessarily. I mean, I'm sure you can crunch the numbers at some point, but it doesn't. And that's not deemed worthy of, you know, like, I'm a sustainability professional right now. If you want to get, if you want to use the language and use the definitions that they use, but I don't necessarily generate income for anybody. And I don't necessarily, you know, that's not like my full-time job. I'm not putting extra labor, so to speak, into it. And so people aren't paying attention to it as much. And I say that to say, you know, like, we've been practicing these things for centuries. Our ancestors were practicing these same things in maybe a slightly different way. If that, it's just evolved over time. But if society isn't able to put a price tag on it for some reason, it's just not deemed worthy enough to pay attention to. And I find that really interesting and also kind of sad because, like, yeah, these people are growing food out of their backyards and sharing it with the community. Or like my neighbor, you know, proverbially, my neighbor is, you know, growing lettuce out of their backyard and they're saying, hey, we have an abundance of lettuce. Do you want some? Right? And I think that that's kind of the practices that I want to get back to when we're talking about sustainability or talking about trying to, you know, work with our environment to actually make sure that we're giving back to it just as much as it's giving us, because it's sustaining us. And the whole issue with the reason, I guess, or part of the reason that we have sustainability professionals is because we're taking more from the earth than it is able to give us. Like, we're overusing all of these resources and also acting like there's not enough resources to go around, which is crazy because it's like, but so much is going to waste at the same time. So how does that really add up? So that's how I feel about it. I am of the belief, and I know because I've seen it from generations and generations, that we have already been practicing sustainability. I technically don't need to get paid to do, you know, the work that I'm seeking, but unfortunately we also live in a society where I do have to pay bills. So
yeah,
I gotta do something, and I, you know, just so happen to want to do something that I'm passionate about. So
yeah, Yeah, and I think for me, the question that came up as I was thinking about putting together this show is, who's defining that? Because if the folks at the front line and the communities who are closest to those folks are not defining that, then it's like, I remember, I think Khaled said this when we were in the show, is that you're speaking about someone else's family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because those folks that are writing the papers, the academic papers or the reports, they're not there. And so you're speaking about someone else's family.
And also making assumptions.
Yeah, a lot of assumptions, right? And I think we can keep going into these things and in these topics. And I know you and I have had different conversations, how these things manifest both at Presidio, but then outside of Presidio too. Getting back to a little bit to, you know, you were saying at some point you want to go back home and do some work there. And we also discussed like, hey, you know, different landscape. So it may not be, it's not going to be the West Coast, right? Like, let's just put it straight. But you also have somewhat of an understanding of what's over there. It, obviously, time has passed and things have changed. And, you know, my hometown has changed too. So I get that. And I'm just curious to know, you know, what does that look like for you? What is your blueprint there? Let me take a guess there. Relationships are going to be a big part of that, right? Because you have to build those relationships to really understand what's going on there before you can come in. And I'm just curious to know, like, what is your strategy there, and what are the things you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, that's a harder question, because I think what you just said is pretty integral. Like, building relationships is key to that. And when you talk about, so I'm stepping more into the organizing space a little bit, in that I want to learn from organizers who are already doing the work, to be able to kind of utilize whatever power I'm able to accumulate to help push that work forward. And that's mostly movement work. And that also means pushing forward these ideas that we have about, or not ideas, they're actually tangible. What's the word? They're tangible notions about how we're affecting the environment as human beings. And so I want to be able to share the knowledge that I've learned, like, thus far, and the knowledge that I'll continue to learn in ways that can be applied to that movement work. And so that requires me to build relationships with people. It requires me to also, you know, come at it from a different angle, which doesn't necessarily mean that I'll be making money off of it. And I don't necessarily want to either, to be honest. What I'm thinking right now, this might change, and I think that's okay. What I'm thinking right now is that I'll probably have to work within, like, a community garden or a community farm to be able, like, volunteer my time to be able to really understand, like, I'm really, really curious about the food insecurity space and the fact, you know, again, that we're not able to, that we keep wasting food and we keep saying there's not enough food to go around, like, but there's, like, 40% of food that we waste in the U.S., you know, out of all the food that we consume. And so it's like dealing with that idea, and also understanding that there are ways to make sure that everybody can be fed. So to me, that looks like working in a community garden. It looks like maybe even working on a farm to make sure that I can understand, like, where that starts and how it actually gets to people.
Yeah,
that's where I'm at right now. So cool, I don't know. Yeah. It might change.
Yeah, and you know that I'm here to support you in whatever way that looks like. I'm curious to know this. You said organizer. Can you dive a little bit and paint a picture to me to what you mean when you say organizer?
Okay, I can try. I'm not.
Yeah, but we're not talking about someone who's just organizing papers, right? Like, or documents,
organizer,
or like something in the job description,
in,
right?
Yeah, no. Somebody organizing as in trying to, in my head, and this is my idea, trying to organize people to, or mobilize people to ensure that they're able to pass ideas back and forth and actually push things forward. So like in our society, we already have a governance system set up. And so navigating that system is one thing, but also being able to imagine what that system could look like outside of the construct that it's having right now. That was a lot of jargon. So I might say that a different way. Essentially, though, I think that it is, at the core of it, it is organizing and mobilizing people is sharing ideas back and forth so that we can grow and evolve as a society, right? Like, in my mind, that's what it is, and that manifests in different ways. So that could look like, excuse me, me protesting, you know, in a specific community that hopefully I belong to. Where, you know, I see something that's not right, and so I'm going to go protest so that my voice can be heard, literally, so that something can change. That could also look like policy work, and it could look like actually being involved in the government and in the governance system that's set up within my community or within the larger society to say, this doesn't look right on paper, you need to change this, and how can we actually implement it later? So, I guess I'm saying organizing can look like a bunch of different ways. For me, hopefully, it's like multifaceted, because humans are multifaceted, but at the core of it, it's really sharing ideas back and forth and understanding like how people share those ideas so that we can grow and change and evolve as a society.
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense.
No, I like it. Yeah. You know, I like what you're saying, because it's like relational and organizing. It's like, I think maybe folks would describe this as like the outside work, right? And to me, it's like the community work. But, you know, I'm curious to know. So you're saying, hey, let's do this one step at a time with relationships and, you know, take that time to build that trust and understanding and learning. I would guess that you also are aware of the places where folks are at the front line, whether that's oil refineries or, you know, it may be near even like a zone where like there's a bunch of factories or mm-hmm. transportation centers. So I honestly don't know much about it. Like I said, I've never been to this part of the country, so. Can you share a little bit of what's out there and where these issues may be showing up, whether that's, you know, refineries or pesticides or whatever it may be?
Yeah. I mean, so at a like leveling for a second, I think that a lot of people, when they hear about climate change or hear about sustainability, and they also think about pollution. And so, in thinking about that pollution, there's a lot of different ways that human beings contribute to pollution. But one of the ways, which is what you're referring to, is, you know, like a lot of the industrial type of pollution that we experience, and especially in the United States, is concentrated to specific areas of the country. And one of those areas is within like the southern United States, and I'm not going to pretend that I'm an expert on this, so I think that I'm not gonna dive too deeply into it, but essentially you have these factories and these very specific industries that are centered within specific communities, and especially in the southern United States. And the factories that are happening, or the factories are producing pollution, and it's not healthy for those communities. It's causing a whole bunch of health disparities within those communities. And I don't think that a lot of people are talking about it because from those factories, that's how we get a lot of our goods. That's how we get a lot of the, you know, different things that have to do with like chemical plants and how we get manufactured food even, or things of that nature. And I think that, or I don't think, but I do know people who work within those factories and also work within those communities, both on the organizing side and also like working as factory workers. And it's just not equitable in terms of how we're thinking about how these factories affect these communities and also how these people who are working in these communities are affected when policies are taken, or when sustainability professionals are like, you know, protesting against these factories, because we're not thinking about, well, how do we, you know, train these people to be able to do other jobs, or how do we make sure that communities and their economic stability isn't affected, you know, solely based on this factory that exists within that community. So, yeah, that's pretty much where I'm going. I'm still, you know, doing my research on it. I'm still, again, trying to build those relationships so that I know what's actually going on, because it's a complex problem, which a lot of these issues are. You know, I think that it's one thing to say we don't want our communities to be affected by pollution and we don't want our environment to be affected by it, but it's another thing to say, well, we still live in a society where it's really necessary that we make sure everybody is able to get their basic human necessities. And for right now, that also includes making sure they have a job. And, you know, you can't just pull jobs away from people because, you know, it's harming people, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's that split, right? That I think it's often talked about that when you do away with some jobs, then, or when you pursue environmental protection or taking care of the quote unquote natural resources, therefore there's going to be less jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily think that's 100% true either.
No. <Okay. laughs> It's just a matter of actually allocating, I guess, the way that we are able to train people and provide different avenues of making income. I don't know. It's a longer process. And it's also about what you're addressing and on what level you're addressing, because you can address it on a federal level, but there's not a one-size-fits-all for the different communities that are affected by these very real environmental outcomes. So, yeah, it's a complex issue.
Yeah. And if I may ask, what has been the thing that has, or the perspective you does change most for you since moving away from there to the West Coast? Like, what has become more apparent since then?
So I think that while I critique the way that we talk about sustainability a lot, and that like when I first moved to the West Coast and started, I guess, coming into my own, so to speak, about how I wanted to approach this sector that's been, you know, designed a little bit. For me, I was like, well, you know, like you all aren't making space for people to feel like they can enter into sustainability. But I think that it's more so, it's not that they're not making space, it's more so that they need to redefine the ways that they are addressing these environmental issues. And essentially, it goes back to the way we utilize the language versus who is given a proverbial seat at the table. I think that we can make our own tables, and, you know, we have the power to be able to do that and talk about sustainability in a way that deviates from what's the norm right now in our culture. But for the most part, I think that being able to actually have conversations that are helpful, we just need to broaden the scope of the sector and broaden the ways that we actually think about sustainability in general. And that comes down to the language, and also comes down to like what relationships people have with each other and how willing people are to share their stories with each other.
Totally. Like the fact that you even said scope, I feel like we definitely need to, like, I didn't learn what scope was till, you know, I dived into the professional space. So like, we definitely need to do that. Cause like,
that's right? Real.
I mean,
no, yeah, hey, so that's definitely real.
What would you tell your younger self, or what is your message for youth who may come to listen to you right now and you know, wonder, how can I do this work, whether it's in whatever part of the country or maybe even outside the United States? They may be listening to you and yeah, I'm just curious to know what kind of message you would send them about what they should be thinking about, or how to organize, what to do, or whatever.
Well, the thing that I like about, you know, in my old age, the youth are doing right now, which is like Gen Z, a generation behind me. I feel like the thing that they're doing great at, and I think that all kids and like youth who are coming into their own do well, is continue to imagine something that is out of what is expected or what is the norm or what is the status quo. And I think that that sounds like pretty corny sometimes, you know, saying it out loud, but at the same time, it's really true. Like the ways that we as adults and professional working people kind of slip into these predefined boxes, it's really easy to lose our ability to think beyond what we see as the landscape right now, right? And there's some very real reasons that that happens. You know, a lot of people want things done now and they want things done quickly. But if we're able to keep that mentality of understanding that we're in the here and now and there's something that could be different, whether that's in a day, whether that's in a week or a year, you know, like, it's really important to keep that imagination and continue to imagine something different, because obviously like things aren't working to the best of their ability, and that's what we're striving for, is it not? So to me, I'm kind of just like, if you're not thinking of something beyond what is our reality right now, you're probably limiting yourself, and it's probably not going to work in your favor.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I mean, you have to stay flexible and adaptable, right? Yeah. Otherwise, that you mold into that box that's set out for you, and once you become all squared, then it's harder for you to go anywhere else, right?
Yeah, then you're boring. It's like, ew.
Yeah, okay, cool. Well, Toby, what are some ways in which folks can find out about you and the things you do? And I know you have a podcast, so this is a good time to plug in anything you'd like to share.
Yeah, so I want to share two specific things. I said earlier that I was working on a few different projects. I wanted to plug a project that I've been working on for a while. It's called Intro to Unhealing, Intro to Healing Internalized Anti-Blackness. So it is for people who are part of the African diaspora, but we've created a course that allows us to essentially, I'm looking for the information so I get it right, but it essentially allows us to reach back within our ancestry and understand like how we came to be, no matter what part of the world you're living in, and understanding that there's a lot of different aspects of our society, our globalized society, but also the United States and the society that I'm personally living in. You know, there's a lot of things that are anti-Black, and especially within the last few months that we've seen, like, this newest racial unrest and reckoning of some sort. It's been apparent that while a lot of non-Black people need healing and also need to unlearn, you know, racism and unlearn the ways that they're being anti-Black, so do Black people. There's a lot of internalized anti-Blackness that manifests itself in different ways and keeps us from progressing forward. So I was able to work with a few classmates from college and also a few other practitioners who run across the gamut. But you can find it on my page, which is Toby with an I, and it's all spelled out T-O-B-I with an I. That's on all platforms, so Instagram and Twitter and probably Facebook as well, but I don't really use Facebook like that. But you should be able to find that course, and also my podcast is called Emotionally Unavailable, and it's just a chill way for us, for me and my co-host Mika Willis, to be able to you know, relax and talk about topics that are important to us living in the society. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for that. I think it's important to make space for that. And I'm sure the courses are great. And I think it's wonderful that you're taking an initiative to take on these issues, because they're really important. Well, any other last words of wisdom, thoughts, shout outs that you'd like to share as we close off this episode?
Shout out to you for this great podcast. I've really enjoyed the episode so far, and I think that, again, hearing stories from different people, being able to communicate and utilize our different languages and how they manifest in different ways is super important. So I'm excited to see how it grows more, and also excited that you invited me on. So I thank you for that.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show, Toby.
Yeah, no problem.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Toby. Clearly, there's a lot of Presidians listening to this podcast, but yeah, I really appreciate having the opportunity to share this with you, this gift with you. Again, this has been day 3 of Community Week. If you've enjoyed this conversation, be sure to leave a comment or suggestion on Apple Podcasts. I would love to hear from you via email or any of our social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And yeah, I will see you tomorrow for day 4, which is Community Day. I'm just really excited to share with you all the different voices of this community that we're growing. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
The communities who are experiencing the worst effects of climate change are those who are best positioned to innovate solutions. Thank you for tuning in and being part of changing the narrative. See you next time at the Climate Frontline.